Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And welcome to a new episode of the Geek Town Behind the Scenes podcast. I'm your host, Dave Elliott, and on this episode, I'm chatting with Goran Backman, VFX supervisor for Pixamundo on the superb Star Wars series, The Mandalorian. As you'd expect with a show like The Mandalorian, there are lots of visual effects sequences split across various VFX companies. One of the areas Pixamundo specialized in for the show was the creature creation. This led to the company developing some innovative techniques to produce various alien animals, most notably the Blurgs, which the Mando has to learn to tame and ride. They also produce versions of the classic Jubax, along with the flying beast Reptavian, the tiny Gorvin snood lizard, and the Quartum, which is otherwise known as a space goat. Outside of the various creatures, they worked on things like the Pick Droids, they did various environments such as Mos Eisley, the Jawa Camp, Lava Fields, and a whole bunch of other things. They also had a chance to play around with the Mandalorian ship, the Razor Crest, as well. In the interview, we talk about all the stuff they worked on and more, and I just wanted to give a huge congratulations to everybody involved in the show, because they've been nominated for 15 Emmys, and I've already picked up 5, including one for cinematography, production design, sound editing, sound mixing, and visual effects. If you like this interview, we also spoke to the now Emmy-winning music editor, Ryan Rubin, on episode 25, so if you go back onto the website or have a look through your feed, you'll find that a few episodes back. If you'd like to hear more episodes of these behind-the-scenes interviews, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcast by searching for Geek Town Radio. This gives you our weekly Geek Town Radio podcast as well, which brings you all the latest TV, film, and gaming news. You can also go to the website at geektown.co.uk for your daily news stories and all the latest UK and US TV premiere dates. Here's the interview with Goran Backman.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Thank you for coming on and spend some time talking to me.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Let's get straight in and just talk about The Mandalorian. Do you want to explain a little bit about your involvement with the show?
I'm a VFX supervisor at Pixamondo, so that means that we will, you know, start with a discussion with the client VFX supervisors about the designs and then go through each shot, each sequence, and then try to lay out the best plan for ourselves to tackle these things. And we're also providing creative and technical direction to the staff while, you know, doing our best to keep the whole project on budget.
Awesome.
That's kind of it in a nutshell.
Yeah. Do you want to just explain some of the elements that you worked on the show as well?
Yeah. So we had a lot of creature work on this show. We had 5 creatures and pit droids. I'm not sure what to call those creatures. Or
I think they are called pit droids. I think you are right.
No, yeah. If you call them creatures or characters. But yeah, there's somewhere in between, I guess. Yeah. So that's always great great fun for us to do that kind of work. It's a very creative type of work, and it challenges everybody here. So that's always fun. We also had some environments as well, like Arbala. We had the quills hit his hut and his pen area there. We did some Tatooine dunes. We worked on creating Mos Eisley, and we had some lava fields as well that we did. We also got to play with the Razor Crest. That was an asset sent to us by ILM, but we did animation. We did the final shots for that as well, and we helped developing some of the, it's kind of like characteristic smoke effects. I'm not sure if you noticed, but it does have kind of a bit of character to it. So we did some of that work as well.
Yes.
We got to play with blaster bolts. I don't know why, but that was actually very satisfying for me, just Star Wars and blaster bolts.
It's just the kid in you that comes out, I think. Yeah. Just want to make, but it's like you want to make the noises whenever you see it,
Yeah. No, for sure. I think so. And we also had some sort of odd little things. We helped design the rifle scope, Mando's rifle scope. That was cool. Kind of interesting too.
Yeah. The creatures, mentions there, various things in it. One of the big ones being the Blurgs, which if you're a Star Wars nerd, you'll know that the Blurgs first appeared in the Battle of Endor movie, the Ewoks film, which I know Jon Favreau is a huge fan of all the Star Wars things, particularly this movie. So do you want to explain a little bit about your process for building the Blurgs and where you kind of start and what you did with it?
So the Blurg, that was a big task for us. And it was the first creature that we did build for the show. We started fairly early on Mandalorian because of the challenges that was going to come from the Blurg. And also it involved what they would be doing on set as well. So that's another reason. So the big challenge here was to place actors riding a believable CG creature that we also get to see a close up.
Yes.
So on the set, the actors sit on a saddle that then sat on top of a practical Blurg's back that then sat on top of a motion base, which is a mechanical device with a bunch of pistons driving it.
Yeah.
And the aim here for us was to get this buck to be driven by our animation. So to achieve this, we developed a system where we can see the motion base with the pistons in our animation software, which is Maya.
Yeah.
And we would have a CG motion base in 3D built to the same specs and the dimensions as its real world counterparts, with the addition of some indicators that would tell us when an animation would get pushed too far.
Right.
So let's say you have the Blurg in 3D space, you attach the motion base to it. Now when you animate the Blurg, motion base then follows, right? So you see exactly how it's all going to work on set. And this really helped us out to make sure that what we gave ILM in the end to drive the buck would actually work out, and we did not have to go back and forth or anything like that.
Okay. So your 3D model, and they're using that to program back into the buck.
Yeah, sort of. What we actually gave them was just the animation data itself. So it was kind of like a set of joints that they fed into the setup on set. So we gave them a bunch of animation cycles, and we gave them some shot-specific stuff and as many kind of animation scenarios that we could think of to give the on-set crew a full range of animation data to use. So then they apply this animation to the motion base, shot whatever they needed to shoot, and they sent the footage back to us. They told us what part of the animation, of our animation, that they used. From there, we would cut up our animations and replace the buck in the footage with our CG Blurg, and watch as things would just line up perfectly. It was a nice feeling when the shots came back and we're like, yeah, it all worked out,
Wow. So, I never thought
this was
doing it that way around, but this is great.
Yeah, it's a really good way of doing it. This way you're ensuring that everything feels real, that the actors' bodies are moving correctly, and all the weights that you expect to see from them, all the inertia from their bodies bodies as they get pushed around. You get all of that right away, and the director can see what they're going to do. You know, sometimes you're asked to push things a little bit further than what they have shot, and that's when you can get into a little bit of problems. You have solutions for that, but if you can do it this way, you know, it's really going to save time and money.
Yeah, I mean, that has been one of the most impressive things about The Mandalorian, is using a lot of technical innovation, I think, to speed up what otherwise would seem to be an incredibly complex VFX heavy show. But mm-hmm. they seem to have come yeah. up with a number of things that help deal with that. I mean, you know, we'll get onto one of them a bit later on, but just going mm-hmm. back to the creatures, you did mm-hmm. some other things as well. Is there any more interesting bits about the Blurgs, or should we move on to some of the others?
Yeah, some of the stuff that we did for the Blurgs that we can go into was, you know, the amount of detail that we would end up seeing. You know, there's one shot where we really get to see the Blurg's face close to the camera.
Yeah.
And Favreau, he really wanted to see the eye and see how this was a living, breathing creature, right?
Yeah.
So we spent a lot of time painting in the correct texture and getting all the hydra stuff in there, you know, getting the small hair from its pores into the acid as well. Even down to the iris of the Blurg itself, you know, we painted in or sculpted in the individual fibers you see inside of the iris. So we actually had that kind
wow.
of depth to it.
That's an incredible amount of detail.
Yeah. So it was a fun asset to work on for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to build some Jubaks as well, I think, for this.
Yeah.
Did you end up building those from scratch, or did ILM hand you some assets to start off with and then you kind of built off them?
They had an asset that they gave us that was, it was a Jubak, but we had to make it high resolution. We had to.
Yeah.
sculpt in a lot of detail, but it was a good starting point for us. And they like to do this a lot, which is super helpful. You know, it cuts down on the communication and back and forth, right? If they can bring us something. Sometimes it's a maquette that they do and give it to the director, get the maquettes approved, and they get a scan done for it, send it to us, you know, things like that. But for the Jubak in particular, we had a lot of discussions with Richard and Doug Chang about how this should look. We took a look at a lot of the signs from existing movies and even games, actually, and also Terry Whitlatch's original design. So try to find the best of all worlds and then put that into the Jubak that we would create. So,
yeah.
you know, we took a look at how the muscles felt, if they felt heavy enough to carry the creature and all those things, you know. And that was kind of a conversation that we always had with them to make sure everything felt real. With the Blurg as well, you know, it's a very front heavy creature. So that was a discussion we had, you know, making sure that the back tail felt heavy enough to make that all balanced.
Yeah, because I mean, we've seen Jubaks on screen before, but it's been a while mm-hmm. ago, so I can't imagine they were that up to date, the files.
They needed some work for sure, but that was expected.
Yeah. So some of the other things you did, there was like a flying, well, I think it's referred to as the flying beast. I don't know whether it has a proper name. It was a kind of pterodactyl type thing, or a dragon type thing, I seem to remember.
You're talking about the Reptavian, I think. Yeah,
right.
So that was a fun sequence for us as well. I mean, so we created the flying creature, as you call it, and also the each shot that was included inside, and that applied to our Blurg as well and Jubak. You know, whenever we had a shot of it, that's when we took the full sequence, generally
right.
speaking. So the Reptavian, it was the same process really. We took a look at some of, they had some original designs, a little bit rougher in this case, so we had probably a bit more freedom to create something with this one. But we also knew that it's going to be seen at darkness, so you know, you spend the money wisely, so it's but we do have one shot where it grabs hold of Mandalorian and takes off, so at the same time, most of the time, you know, 90% of it you would be in darkness, and then we have this one hero shot, so we would always have to keep that in mind.
So when it goes and grabs the Mandalorian like that, is that sort of shot a mixture of live footage of the Mandalorian, or is that a replacement, like a digital replacement of him?
Yeah, in that shot in particular, they actually dragged Mandalorian across the floor for a guy with some wires.
Right.
So some wire, paint.
I'm sure it wasn't Pedro Pascal in that. I'm sure that was one of the stunt ones.
Yeah, I believe so. We had to paint some wires for that, and then we animate to the performance on the footage, you know, and it's a little bit of a puzzle piece there to have to make sure, you know, or him is moving his arm there, you know, maybe we can put the leg there and try to push it. Or, you know, it's kind of going backwards a little bit because Reptavian is the driving force in the shot. We don't have the luxury to do that in this case. I think that sequence turned out really well, actually.
Yeah, good sequence. And there was a shot of a space goat, I seem to remember it.
Yeah, I think that was Hal Hickel, the animation supervisor, the first call of that. At least through our conversations, we had a good giggle about that. Yeah, that's official name is the Quartum. So I'm not sure if you remember, but in the old Star Wars, they sometimes have a kind of establishing shots and they show a creature sitting in the corner, you know. So it's kind of like a nod back to that.
Right,
that was the whole purpose of that. So he actually only has one shot.
Yeah. Seems to be quite a lot of work for one shot. But I mean, now you've got it. I mean, you never know. You might need to create a field of space goats. Maybe you'll come across a space goat herder at some point and they'll need more of them. So
yeah, spin off.
Yes, entire show about a space goat herder. Is there any other creatures you did? I know there were kind of little creatures and stuff. Were there anything else you did?
The Gorbin Snoo, which is a lizard that you see in the sequence where Mandalorian gets attacked.
Yes.
And we talked about the pit droids briefly as well. Yeah, I think that covers the ones that we did for creature work. Yeah.
I mean, again, with the pit droids, there are obviously some existing assets for that and they have to look a particular way. So I guess you don't get an awful lot of freedom into exactly how they work because there is a lot of reference for that.
Yeah, shape-wise, we just talked very closely to what we were given. So we were given an asset for that.
Yeah.
We changed up the texture a little bit and there's a large chunk of our work for the assets itself. Then, you know, we did the animation as well for them and spent a lot of time trying to keep the kind of comedy and the nervousness.
They must be fun. That must be fun to do the animations, yeah.
Yeah, no, they're a lot of fun to work with, yeah, for sure. Yeah. Our character animators, they love working on those ones.
Yeah. You also mentioned that you do some of the wilderness scenes and some of the larger towns and that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
For some of the more wilderness scenes, would you have any particular real world references you're using for those?
So for Arvala, we used a lot of photos from Death Valley. So Island, they sent out staff over there to take a lot of pictures for us. They had a massive library of the photos and 3D scans that they had available to all the different vendors. They also included Iceland and photos from Hawaii that was used for a lot of the stuff from Navarro. And then a lot of these photos were then used to create the 3D assets using photogrammetry, which is the process of triangulating points between images.
Right.
You basically feed the camera a bunch of photos, usually like at least 50, but it can go up to a lot more than that, a few hundreds. And then the computer like figures out a point that is seen in multiple images where that lives in 3D space and then spits out a 3D geometry for that. So Island, they started building a lot of that stuff. Sometimes we just looked at photos that they gave us and then created our own photogrammetry asset from that as well. So that was super helpful, you know, and it also cuts down on questions between the vendors and the island themselves, you know, because we have such a good base to go from.
Yeah, yeah. Now we get into these larger scenes and stuff. One of the things which is unique with The Mandalorian was this thing that ILM and a bunch of other people came up with, the volume. Which is this, I mean, I don't know whether you're any better at explaining this than I would be.
I could give it a shot.
Go on.
The volume here, this is one of the biggest changes in how we create visual effects since our industry's inception, I think.
Yeah.
So the question here was, we have 8 episodes of Star Wars, which of course has a massive scope in terms of different locations, etc., for episodic television production, while they were shooting one episode per 10 days, I think. So that's a very tight schedule. So you can't really do what you traditionally do in a Star Wars production, which is they used to go to places like Tunisia. Travel over there and shoot things there or Bolivia or whatever it might be. So due to the time restrictions on Mandalorian, there's no chance to do that. So, and even so, you often have to do set extensions on the footage that you get back from it. So this is the main reason why John and Richard Luff went with this option. So the volume here solves all solve these problems. So if I want to nerd out for a little bit and explain what it actually is, in more technical terms, it's a 20 feet tall cylindrical shape, which I think had up to 270 degrees around the practical set that resides in the middle. It is 75 feet across, and I think they had over 1,300 LED panels blasting 1,800 nits from them, so that they can get very bright.
Yeah.
And on these panels, ILM ran a CG environment in real time on the screen, and then you have a virtual camera displaying the environment that is also tracked to match the practical camera inside of this volume, so that you get the correct parallax as this camera is moving and rotating.
Yeah.
So you have, imagine you're stepping into a big cylindrical shape, and everything around you is a real-time environment. And then through the camera's frustum, you project a live image. This is done to, say, render time. You know, even if it's real-time, it's still like you have to ensure that we can record things as efficiently as possible, which also means that you can have high resolution of the assets on the real-time screen, right? So that was how that was done, generally speaking. So the other benefits, apart from the mentioned ones, is you get correct reflections on in particular Mandalorian. He's very reflective with his helmet and his armor, but also you get the correct lighting, the more diffusive lighting on everything, on the practical subjects, on the actors. As a director and filmmaker, you can frame things against the background with confidence because you know what you are framing. It's not against the green screen where you kind of have to imagine, oh, wouldn't it be nice to have this thing here, blah, blah, the sky, maybe it's sun over there. No, that's the things that you later have to communicate to the post-production people like us. With this change, now you see everything right away inside the lens. You know, you can shoot a scene at dawn for the whole day if you need to. You can change the sun position, you know, and even if your environment, if you feel like you have to throw up green screen, it was very rare that that happened, but if you, for whatever reason, you want to do that, at the flick of a switch, you have a green screen, a perfectly lit green screen on this volume as well. And that in itself is another benefit, because lighting a green screen and setting that up can take a lot of time. And it's, you know, it's people on set waiting around for that to happen. So this was another benefit.
Yeah, it was one of those things that the first time I saw it, I mean, it's essentially, it is a giant LED video screen, and the camera acts as a kind of game controller to control the background, I guess, would be the...
Exactly.
Yeah. It's just an incredible breakthrough bit of technology, because of watching the show, you would have no idea that 90% of that is shot indoors. It's a phenomenal bit of tech.
I mean, my jaw dropped when Richard first showed me how this was done. You know, I was like, that is what you guys are doing? Wow. And he showed the final footage first, and I think it was of Herzog sitting inside his bunker, and just looked real.
Yeah.
You know? And then you cut to a different camera showing how it's all done, and that's when you go like, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah, it's just an incredible bit of technology. And I mean, for you, I guess, I mean, sort of takes away some of your work, because it's also probably some of the work that's a biggest pain to do. Things like reflections, would you say, you know, Mandalorians, you wouldn't have been able to have a shiny outfit for the Mandalorian, I don't think, or it would have been a lot more expensive to do that.
Yeah, sometimes you end up replacing things like that if the environment turns out to change later on down in post-production. You often have to track in a 3D helmet, let's say, and then, you know, you put in a new reflection on that, so we did not have to do any of that.
Yeah, so you've got things like that. It gives the actors something to act to, and you're not having to cut people out all the time off green screen, which I imagine must be a ball-aching job for VFX people.
Yeah, we do a lot of that, but it was nice for change to have much less of that, for sure.
Yeah, so for you, it just must have made a huge difference, even though, you know, you're not there shooting it, just getting that footage afterwards must make a huge difference.
Yeah, no, I know, it was a real game changer for us, and an eye-opener. You know, it was a fantastic experience to even just be part of this new way of working, and being one of the first people to get to experience that. Yeah.
Okay, so some more general things about The Mandalorian. What would you say was the most challenging shot for you that you worked on?
I must say that would be the Blurg sequences where Mandalorian is riding on top of it.
Right.
So yeah, I think that was a really involved involved process. It took us a while to get everything sorted out. It was pretty straightforward, to be honest with you. It's just, it's a long process in itself, you know? Mm. So I think that was most challenging for sure, you know, and sometimes we did not even expect the buck and motion base to be able to perform according to what the story needed. So in those cases, we did that, a digidouble of Mandalorian writing it. And, you know, that would be another challenge, I guess. So you really have to nail down the animation to sell it all. Yeah.
And do you have a particular favorite shot from season one?
That's like you're asking me to pick my favorite shot.
Yes, I know.
I mean, I think the shot that we discussed before where the Octavian is picking up Mando, I think that worked out really nicely. I like how, you know, the lighting works on it, the light from the fire lighting up the creature from below. And another one that I really like was it's a wide shot of the Blurg with Mandalorian where he is inside the Quill's pen when he's trying to tame the Blurg. Yeah. I don't know, it's something really nice about it. It's the framing, we have the light direction, looks really nice, and also it shows, of course, our most complex asset being the Blurg, and also a full CG background in the distance. So everything that is outside of the fence is actually CG.
Wow.
So it's a big shot for us. But that whole sequence as a whole was good fun to work on and shows off a lot of that background work.
Yeah. I was going to say, is there a shot you like to point out that might surprise the audiences of VFX? But we've kind of talked about the volume. So, you know.
That's a big surprise, I think. I hope so. I mean, it surprised me, you know, and I knew something was coming when they were talking about it.
Yeah.
So yes, absolutely. On the flip side, though, there's a interesting enough one shot with the Blurg being a puppet.
Wow.
So, yeah, John. I mean, he did the puppet sort of aspects of the original movies a lot, so he wanted to have a shot with that in it. And it's this shot where Mando is using his plasma rifle to look around, and he lands on a Blurg hanging out in the distance. And that shot is a stop motion shot.
Oh wow.
So yeah.
That's awesome.
That's it. Yeah.
Going back to the battle for Endor versions. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I really appreciated that. I thought it was a nice touch of him to go with that, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. So moving on to sort of to more general things. Mm-hmm. Mandalorian is the main thing we've been able to talk about. You have worked across a bunch of other shows as well. I noticed Star Trek Discovery, Westworld, Lock and Key, some bits and pieces on the Wonder Woman movie.
Yeah.
The company as a whole has done stuff on Picard, See, the Apple TV show, which I absolutely love.
Yeah, it's a great one.
Counterpart, Carnival Row, The Boys, Game of Thrones and The Orville, because I think every VFX company has done something on Game of Thrones and The Orville. It seems to be that way. Do you have any particular one thing that you've done, not necessarily just on The Mandalorian, but out of all the stuff that you've done that you've been particularly proud of?
That's a tough one to pick, I think. I mean, if I were to say show, I would actually say Mandalorian.
Well, of course, because, yes. Other than The Mandalorian, I think, maybe.
Yeah. I think we did some work on Fast and Furious 8. That was great fun. I'm happy with that because there was a lot of different things we got to do, and there was a lot of things that it's a wide range of things. We got to do some water simulations and, you know, full CG replacements of digidoubles, and it was just like a vast range of things. So that was a good experience, and I think it looks really good in the end as well.
Yeah. Do you have a particular favorite type of VFX to work on? I mean, you know, like water, fire, I don't know, crashes, explosions.
I don't think I'd be surprised to hear this for creatures. I think a lot of us would say that, actually. Yeah. That is something that we really love to do at Epics Among. It really challenges every department, you know, and it's a lot of fun to work on, to get down to the nitty-gritty of it all, including muscle simulations and, you know, skin sliding and, you know, how light travels through skin, etc. It's just so much goodness there to work on. So I would say that for sure, you know.
Yeah.
We did, speaking of muscles, we did some of that as well on Mandalorian for the Blurgs. John was, you know, he wanted to still keep the kind of like look that they had previously, so we didn't do too much of it. We developed a system where we allowed animators to drive the muscle simulation a lot, you know, so they could go in there and really tweak things so they didn't feel like too muscly, you know, and didn't have too much of overlap in the muscle, so just like firm enough to still feel like it was not a stretch from what we have seen before in the Star Wars universe.
Yeah. The Blurgs, just brilliant. brilliant, the way they came out. I thought they came out really well.
Thank you.
Other than The Mandalorian, what would you say is the most interesting experience you've had while working in VFX?
I would say this is, again, going back to Mandalorian a little bit, but we are in this revolution in our industry now, and we're going from offline to online renders, meaning, you know, offline being, you know, the slow waiting time of sometimes hours to see a single frame to real-time renders.
Right, and yeah.
It's just a massive change from what we in post-production have been doing for so long, you know? And it cuts down the feedback loop for everybody, meaning how fast we get to see iterated versions of everything, you know, lighting, environments, and all kinds of, you know, benefits that we get from that. So this is something that we will end up seeing a lot of in the future, and it's just such a massive change that I would put that down as one of the most interesting experiences I've had in the so far. Yeah.
If I was a film producer, I would be begging whoever runs the studio for a volume, I think, like every studio I worked at from now on.
Yeah. No, it will happen. Yeah. Rest assured.
Particularly at the moment when you're trying to shoot in the middle of a pandemic, if you could, you know, rather than having to try and get everybody out to a country or a particular location, if you can basically control an environment, which is what you need to be able to do, that's going to be a lot easier.
Yeah, for sure. Right?
So last couple of questions for you, as we cover a lot of TV shows on the site, they're always the same for everybody. So the first question is, what TV shows are you watching at the moment?
So many, but I really got into Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, actually. Oh, it looks gorgeous. It's got that. Some fantastic writing. Yeah, are you watching it as well?
Oh, yeah. I was a huge Gilmore Girls fan, and then that came along from the same people, and the writing's the same, and I love the environment, and it's just hilarious. It's one of my favorite shows.
Yeah, it's such a great show. We just put it on here one day, and then we like find ourselves watching 5 episodes in one day. You know, it really gets you hooked. I also started watching The Boys, which is which is a very good show. Yeah,
fabulous. Yeah, I've been watching that as well. That's been brilliant. The second season's just landed.
I haven't gone that far, so no spoilers.
You'll love it though. I mean, it's just brilliant. I really, really enjoy that show. Mm-hmm. And if you had the opportunity to work on any TV show, it can be something from the past, something present, or something future, which show would it be?
I must go back to the Star Wars here, actually. Once again, you know, the original Star Wars trilogy, they had so much new innovation. It must have been a great time for them to try to figure out everything. You know, they had to think up new solutions for so much many different things, you know, things have never been done. You know, it must have been a real fun experience for them, and probably a little bit of a loss of hair at the same time. But it was just, everything was new, you know. And just right now, it's getting quite easy to do a lot of things. I mean, I should say, quote unquote, easy. It's not careful. Really easy, but we know how to tackle things fairly well. You know, we have a wide range of things that we do, but we know how to do it. We know the process to do it and what's the most efficient way to do it, etc. But back then, you know, it must have been exhilarating.
Yeah. So sort of late 70s ILM is probably where you want to be.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. I think that would be a fascinating place to be.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you for spending a bit of time to come on and talk to me. I love the show. I'm massively looking forward to the second season of it coming out soon as well. I've been fascinated by the VFX for it, particularly things like the volume. So just great to be able to sit down and chat with somebody about it.
Oh, well, thank you for having the interest as well, you know, and it's been fun talking to you as well.
Awesome. I shall let you go. It's been lovely chatting with you, and hopefully, you know, when some of your other stuff comes out, you can come back on and talk about whatever that is when you can talk about them.
Yeah, sure. Looking forward to that. Yeah.
Awesome. Have a great rest of the day, and hopefully speak to you soon.
Yeah. All right. Bye for now.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.